Our first case is case number 67170, Atwal versus State. Ms. Navarro for the appellant, Mr. Burton for the respondent.
May I approach him?
Yes, please do, and would you like to reserve some time? Okay.
May it please the court. Good morning, Justices of the Supreme Court. My name is Melissa Navarro, and I represent Paul Atwal. On September 16, 2014, Paul Atwal went to trial on the charges of battery by strangulation and coercion, both felonies. The trial was a short two-day trial, but the brevity of the trial did not prevent the erroneous rulings made by the district court. The first error occurred during jury selection, when the state discriminatorily used their peremptory challenges to exclude three men from the jury. This error is structural and requires reversal. The second error occurred when the court failed to instruct the jurors on the defense proposed jury instruction on the lesser-included misdemeanor offense of coercion. Lastly, the state failed to provide enough evidence to prove coercion. I want to focus on the first two. Turning to the prosecutor's use of peremptory challenges, JEB v. Alabama held that the state cannot exercise their peremptory challenges solely on the basis of gender, because it would be a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Under the first step of the JEB analysis, the defendant must establish a prima facie case of gender discrimination. Here, Judge Levitt said there was no prima facie case of gender discrimination. Judge Levitt was wrong. First, a significant portion of peremptories exercised by the state were used to exclude men. Under Lisby, the court looks at the pattern. In this case, the first peremptory exercised by the state excluded a man. The second excluded a man. The third excluded a man. Finally, the defense attorney, Mr. Lippman, stood up and objected and said, "Judge, I'm looking at the box. Right now, there's 12 people. Four are male, and three of the four are being challenged by the state." And I quote, "We are not going to be left with many males now." Under the Lisby analysis, we think that appellant met its burden in showing that there was gender discrimination. However, looking at under the Watson analysis, there were 23 post-challenge qualified veneer persons, and only 9 of them were men. So the veneer comprised 39% of the men. If you look at how many peremptories the state used against men, 100. 100% of their peremptories were used against a group that only comprised of 39%. Under Watson, we've proven gender discrimination, or at least we've made a prima facie case of gender discrimination. Watson also says you need to look at things like whether this case is sensitive to bias. Yes, this case was sensitive to bias. It was a case about a man hitting a woman. It's always going to be sensitive to gender bias. They look at the prosecutor's questioning, whether you focus more of your questioning on one gender or the other. In this case, there was one question by the prosecutor. During voir dire, when it was his turn to ask the jury questions, he asked one question. And the question was whether they would find that someone who drank would, I think they quoted, they said, "Do you have a bias towards people who drink alcohol?" There was no response.
As to the defense's position that there was a violation, what was the court's initial response?
The court's initial response was that there was no pattern of gender discrimination, to which the prosecutor then responded,
was the prosecutor asked to respond, or was it a voluntary response?
The court then said, "I think you need to respond. I think you need to make a record." The prosecutor said, "Well, if you find that there is no prima facie case of gender discrimination, I don't think I have to make a record." But Judge Levitt persisted and said, "Make a record." That's when the prosecutor then got his notebook and started to explain why he excluded certain men from the jury. And I can go to that prong. Now, in that prong, the state has to offer gender-neutral reasons. We feel like the gender-neutral reasons were a pretext for gender discrimination. The most stark, the best example of this is Mr. Fazzolari. The state said that they excluded Mr. Fazzolari from the jury because he indicated that he was a minister for a Jehovah Witness group. And he said, in my personal experience, from what I understand, there's no drinking, smoking, any of that. I didn't want that to color the perception of the event based on the fact that he was a minister. But there are several problems with this analysis. First of all, Mr. Fazzolari was never asked, do you have a bias against people? No, he was asked whether he had a bias, and he said no. The only thing that Mr. Fazzolari ever discussed was a breaking into his house where he said, I was satisfied with the work of the police. I could be fair and impartial. The courts have held that when you make blanket statements like, because he's a Jehovah's Witness, he wouldn't like people that drink, when you make those blanket statements, those are improper because you haven't delved into whether that bias exists. In addition, the state's second correct array was Mr. Thomas. He said, I excluded Mr. Thomas because he was an engineer, and in my experience, engineers try to reconstruct the crime. Similarly, Mr. Bellman, because it was a medical student who may have applied his knowledge to the facts of the case. Under the comparative analysis of Watson, you look at other jurors. In this case, Ms. Walters was a veterinarian. She obviously had the same medical background that Mr. Bauman had. And Ms. Walters was not. Justice Chair, do you have a question?
No, I was thinking, I have a question on you.
Despite her being a veterinarian, having the medical knowledge, taking all the classes that he probably was taking at UNLV, she was not excluded. Then you have Ms. Sam, who had a degree in psychology, obviously had training in science. She wasn't excluded. Ms. Gordon also had extensive medical knowledge because she was a nurse and had an RN degree. To say that you excluded Mr. Bauman because of his medical knowledge, why didn't you exclude all the other women?
I do. The question I have is really, really basic to this. You know, when we deal with bats on with race, it's a little easier to understand exactly what the thoughts are of both the prosecution and the defense. In this particular case, but for the fact that it was a man hitting a woman, if it had been a burglary case, would this have even mattered that they exclude men? Let's say you have a burglary case, you end up with 12 women on the jury. I mean, are you basing it mainly on the fact of the facts of this case rather than the actual Batson analysis?
No, of course not. I think when you strike any juror based on your preconceived notions of these stereotypes of gender, that's enough. So it's not the fact that this case in particular had issues with gender. It's any case, quite frankly, but the Watson court did say, hey, look at those issues. But if it was a burglary and they struck four men simply because they were men, there would be a problem with that, absolutely. And it would require reversible error, structural error.
See, if it was a burglary case and you had, you let the medical student go, but you kept the nurse, I mean, that's why I can't see it in that particular scenario. But of course, it's hypothetical, and we have to deal with the facts that we have here, the type of case we have with a man supposedly assaulting a woman. So,
and that's why I think it's stronger in this case, Your Honor, and that's why the court should reverse and look at the justifications that the state gives for excluding these men are simply pretextual. There's also an issue that I'd like to address with respect to the coercion instruction not given, and I think that's just as important. This case was important because the defense asked for the coercion misdemeanor. The state and the judge said, you haven't provided enough evidence to get that jury instruction. Now, under Will says the defendant is entitled to the theory of defense instruction when it is supported by some evidence, no matter how weak or incredible, which if believed would support a corresponding jury verdict. Failure to instruct would be reversible error. Even before Rosas, we have Lisby, and Lisby said, if there's enough evidence for the lesser included, you have to give it.
And what was the evidence?
In this case, Ms. Zubik testified that she was strangled, she was choked by the defendant, and at some point she tried to make a phone call, and that she was able to get the phone, dial zero, speak to the operator, and ask for police. At that point, she alleged that Otwell took the phone and threw it against the wall. The contention by Mr. Lippens was that his theory of defense was that any force used to throw the phone had happened after she had the ability to call 911, so he did not prevent her from calling assistance through the use of force. What's important in this case, and I know my time's running up, what's important in this case is the jury had some credibility issues with Ms. Subic. She was inebriated, she couldn't recall some of the facts of the case. For the battery by strangulation, they found that she did not, they didn't believe that she was strangled, and they just found for the battery misdemeanor.
As to your issue of force, you're attempting to make a distinction as to the force being used against the person versus the force being used against, i.e. the phone within that context. Did you have any case, or do you have any case authority as to that distinction you're attempting to make?
And Your Honor, I think that our contention is based entirely on the intent required with that.
So you have no case authority?
At this point, no, Your Honor. Thank you.
Ms. Burke.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Christopher Burton from the Clark County District Attorney's Office on behalf of Respondent. Your Honors, I'm going to follow the same outline that Ms. Navarro set and speak about the JEB challenge and then speak about the coercion lesser included instruction. Your Honors, in this case, the JEB challenge was overruled by Judge Leavitt because at the time that it was made, there were three peremptory strikes exercised, and at that time, she held that there was not a prima facie case determined. The reason she did so is because Mr. Lippman, to his credit, specifically told her, the only thing I have is three strikes. I don't have anything else that suggests that these are gender-related. All I have are these strikes. And as this court said in Watson, something more must be shown than the fact that a minority or someone other.
What is that something more that has to be shown?
So in this case, a pattern must be shown, both during jury selection as well as during the actual exercise of peremptory
strikes. That can be, that may be a pattern.
I think you're certainly in certain cases, yes. But in this case, especially when it comes to gender, because, and here's why. Because unlike race, anytime you strike somebody, it's a 50-50 proposition. They're always going to either be a male or a female. And so you're going to have to show more of a pattern if that's all you have. If you don't have questioning, if you don't have statements, if you don't have a record of disparate treatment between a juror who's male and a juror who's female, if all you have is they're striking males or they're striking females, you're going to have to show more because every time a strike is exercised, it's always going to either be a male or a female. It's a 50-50 proposition. And I would note that at the end of jury selection, the exact same amount of males that started, the exact same proportion of males, actually served on the jury. And that's because at the same time that the state was exercising peremptories, the defense was exercising peremptories. And the exact same proportion of gender was carried through to the actual jury that served. So you don't have this situation where you're striking all of the males and there are no males left, or all of the females, or all of the racial minorities, and there are literally no minorities on the actual jury that served. 39% of the males that were on the panel served on the jury itself. But then moving on to the gender-neutral reasons that were provided by the state. Your Honors, what I want to point out to opposing counsel is that peremptories are different than strikes for cause. We're not talking about people that are entirely unfit to serve. We're not talking about people that should be excused because everyone can agree, or at least the judge can agree, that they have some bias that will be a problem.
The court understands that, but the court is concerned when we are given facts that indicate that the same discretion wasn't exercised toward other juries that were offered for strikes of the stricken jurors. As was pointed out, if the position is because of medical knowledge, it supposedly was offered.
Certainly.
Other people. So if you'll speak to that, what
absolutely.
They've offered.
Absolutely, because it transcends right into what I'm speaking about, which is it's a game of relativity. Which ones are more or less acceptable than others? And so that moves right towards Mr. Bowman, and that's the only juror to which they provide this kind of comparative juror analysis. And they say, well, look, there's three women that have, you know, what they argue are medical or science backgrounds, and you didn't strike these three women, you struck the male with the medical background. But I would argue that they are entirely distinct propositions. First of all, as to, and we'll go juror by juror.
Let's start with the person who was stricken. This person's degree, if I'm not mistaken, was in business.
The person that was stricken had a bachelor's degree in business and was doing post-bachelorette work that was geared towards going to medical school. So he was a current full-time student throughout the University of Nevada geared towards applying to medical school. That is correct. So then we have Ms. Walters, who is a practicing vet, went to school for veterinarians, and I would argue that there is an obvious line of difference between when you're concerned about medical evidence towards a human being presented at trial and someone that went to veterinarian school and that concern being clearly addressed.
Are you basically telling us that a person that goes to veterinarian school knows nothing about basic science?
No, I'm not. What I'm saying is that
how things die and how things live and how things bleed and don't bleed?
No, I'm not, Your Honor. What I'm saying is, again, this is a game of relativity. And if I'm worried about the fact that I don't have
a medical... It's more than a game because we have people who, at the end of the day, either go to prison or don't go to prison. So this is a very particular, to use your phrase, game. And so we start looking at these comparisons to see if they, in fact, make sense.
And if you prefer, I would use a process of relativity.
Whatever you use, the concern is it should make sense. So I'll allow you to explain how it makes sense.
Understood. If I'm looking during a process of relativity at a person who has current studies in female and male anatomy and female and male medical issues, and versus someone who went to school some time ago, 9 years ago at least, and is a practicing veterinarian for animals, and I recognize that I'm not going to have a doctor. All I'm going to have, as to the medical testimony in this case, is my victim who's going to speak about the injuries that she suffered and the feelings that she had, the feeling that she was going to die at the time that she was being choked by the defendant. I'm going to draw that line and say, I'm more concerned about someone who is an actual practicing full-time medical student. And then we move on to Ms. Sam, who had a double major in psychology and social work. Not psychiatry, not anything medically related, certainly something science related, but not anything medically related, who worked as a tutor, who worked as someone who helped children with their schooling, helped children prepare for the SAT. There's a clear distinction between who's going to be more or less acceptable between this person who I'm striking, Mr. Bowman, and this person who I'm leading, Ms. Sam. Finally, we get to Ms. Gordon, who had a bachelor's in nursing, and I would agree that this is probably the closest that the defense actually gets to someone who would be fair to look at in a jury or a comparative analysis, because she had a nursing degree. But the difference here is that she was a school nurse. She had a bachelor's in nursing, then she had significant postgraduate work, a master's degree in teaching, and she currently worked as a school nurse. So again, if I'm going through a process of relativity, looking
relativity,
at...
Relativity, you use the term school nurse almost in a derogatory tone.
I'm not using... I'm not. I just want to correct the record. I'm not.
The background and training of nurses, an RN, I think she was an RN.
She was.
Okay. This other individual we're talking about was in kind of a pre-med program.
Correct.
He had a bachelor's, but he was in a pre-med. He wasn't a, quote, a medical student. He was a pre-med at best. So This is where the comparison gets difficult in this, that trying to weigh these two things for equal or one being more than the other.
And I understand that, Your Honor. But here's what else I would point out as to Ms. Gordon. She was actually struck from the jury. She was struck fourth. So we have an incomplete record here. It's not as if we could say, well, Ms. Gordon was left on the jury and the state never exercised any kind of peremptory challenge toward Ms. Gordon. We have an incomplete record where she may have been struck by the state had they been given the chance to actually strike her. At the time of the strike of Mr. Bowman, I will agree that she was still on the jury.
But and that's part of the window that we have to look at that time, what is in our record and what is being offered. We have a seemingly incomplete record if we don't stop with the judge at the first stage saying that there was no basis, no pattern. If we get into the next step, it becomes more problematic because there was nothing was offered by defense because they were not asked, because the court had already ruled and the court did not make any findings.
Correct.
So we're really left with the first step of whether or not there was a clear pattern. And then we have a little inclusion that, as you say, kind of we have to sit and balance that.
Correct.
As and the reasoning.
Correct. And if Your Honor is concerned that you're left with this somewhat incomplete record, I would point Your Honors to Libby, where this court ruled that a prima facie case had been met and then remanded the matter for the following or the subsequent steps of Batson. A discussion or arguments between the parties, a proffer of gender or race neutral reasons in that case from the prosecutor, and a finding by the district court as to whether those reasons are credible or not. And I would point to the Batson and the JEB line of cases, both federal and state, that talk about that this is a question of genuineness, and that inquires to the credibility of the prosecutor that's actually proffering these reasons. And I would agree with Your Honor that in this case, that kind of analysis, those kinds of findings, were not done by the district court. So we don't have this analysis of examining Mr. Westmeyer, in this case, his decorum and his approach to jury selection.
If we find that we have difficulty with this, why should we look at remanding versus reversing and remanding?
Because that's what the Libby case prescribes. In cases where the Batson or the JEB analysis is left undone, to have a finding, because that's what this court would look for, is a factual finding by the district court. Is the proffered reason credible or genuine in the eyes of the court, and even after the defense proffers why that might be a pretextual reason? And then this court would review that and determine whether further steps, reversal, what have you, are appropriate. If Your Honors have no further questions on JEB, I would just like to really quick move on to the coercion. In this case, there was absolutely no evidence proffered to support a lesser included. And I would distinguish the lesser included that was requested from coercion to the lesser included that was requested for battery by strangulation. In one instance, the battery by strangulation, a lesser included instruction of battery was provided because there was evidence to support it. Judge Leavitt fully well knew her duties to provide lesser included instructions so long as there is some evidence to support it. And the record bears that out as she asks again and again for Mr. Littman to provide the evidence that he thinks supports a coercion lesser included, a coercion without the use of force. And even here during oral argument, it seems that opposing counsel continues to argue, well, the force must be towards the person and not towards some inanimate object. There's a couple of problems with that. First, the way that this was charged. The charging document reads that coercion was committed by the defendant disabling the telephone and preventing her, the victim in this case, from calling for assistance. That would include both the fact that he was choking her at the time she placed the call, and I would respectfully disagree with opposing counsel that she was able to, you know, make this call without any problems. In fact, she calls, and as she's trying to choke out the words, she gets as far as, please send P, P, before he rips the phone out of the wall. So she's not able to finish that call, and her call is not the reason that police are actually taken or sent to her room. It's because when he grabs that phone, using force to rip it out of the wall and stop her from continuing that phone call, she takes that opportunity to flee the room, and she meets the first hotel employee she can find and begs him to call police. That's how police get to the room. That's how authorities are found in this case, or are sent to the room in this case. So there was just no evidence to support. Judge Leavitt was asking for some evidence that there was coercion without any force, and there just wasn't in this case, because the defense strategy was to acknowledge that there was a battery, but not strangulation, in that he grabbed her throat, and that there was that he threw the phone across the room, and that's coercion with the use of force. If there are no other questions, I will yield the rest of my time.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bell, as you approach, do the cross-examination of the victim in this case, the alleged victim in this case. Does the cross-examination entitle the defendant to a lesser-included offense instruction?
Yes.
What was that cross-examination?
The state, Mr. Lippin really worked on challenging her credibility and asking her whether she remembered events, whether she remembered the name of the man that she had been in the hotel room, whether she remembered the name of other people that she had drank with, how much she had drank. And I think what Mr. Lippin was trying to do is trying to challenge some of the things that she remembered. Now, when a witness says something, I was choked, I was strangled, I couldn't breathe, the jury can then decide, do I believe this woman? Do I believe that she was in a state where she remembers everything accurately? In the case where she's saying, and there's differences in the way she kind of says it. He was strangling me, I kind of twisted, and then I picked up the phone, I tried to call the police, and then he threw the phone. It's unclear whether the intent was used as the continuing of the choking and the batter, or whether it was used to prevent Ms. Zubik from calling for assistance. And the fact that Mr. Lippman asked about whether she could remember, whether she was inebriated, whether she was drunk, how tipsy was she, would lend the jury to believe, hey, maybe I don't believe everything she's saying. Maybe she was coerced, or maybe he was trying to prevent her from getting help, but he didn't do it through the use of force. And that's up to the jury. Remember, the standard is however weak, however slight. If there's evidence, you leave it up to the jury. And then the state can respond to the jury in their closing and say, that's completely erroneous, that makes no sense. Let them argue whatever they want to argue, but at least the jury is the one who decides what whether it's a coercion misdemeanor or a coercion felony. Was it done without force, or was it done with force? Or was he just simply not guilty? The other issue that I think I wanted to follow up on is the remedy. With respect, the state said, in Lisby, when there was no record of sufficient record kind of explored in the second prong of the analysis, they remanded it. Well, one of the things that the defense attorneys complained about in Lisby was, hey, a lot of time has elapsed. And if you remember, it was amazing. They did a gender discrimination challenge, and the prosecutor said, I'm not going to give any reason, because at this point, the Supreme Court hasn't held that gender discrimination applies to, that there's a Batson challenge for gender discrimination. In that case, he didn't even respond. Here, we have enough of a record to determine this, and that's why reversal is warranted and not remand and have a hearing. I just wanted to make that specific. And another thing, and I think the court was focusing on this, and it was proper. As the state is giving its reasons as to why, the medical opinions of a veterinarian versus a medical student differ, it falls apart. You can tell that it's completely pretextual because it makes no sense. And with that, Your Honor, unless there's any more questions.
One question is, as you made the argument in terms of the analysis of dismissal, first individuals who were dismissed or not dismissed, counsel raises the issue that the jury that was selected still falls within the parameter, should we take that into consideration?
The parameter of the composition?
Yes.
I think the court made a valid point when it said that you look at it at the time that the strikes were done. Because you don't know what defense strategy was once he started seeing what he was doing to the males. And a lot of the preempts made by Mr. Lipman were men, women. Had the state not done so many for the men, I don't know if Mr. Lipman would have done that. And that's why I asked the court not to consider that. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, the court thanks both counsel for their advocacy in this matter and the briefs that were prepared. And having been in the criminal justice system for 46 years, I don't want to shock you about how old I am. I see two very bright futures, one with the district attorney and one with the public defense office. Congratulations, both of you. Excellent arguments. Very impressed. This case.